well, let's get started. Thank you all for joining, and good afternoon. My name is Barbara Rafson, and I'm the President and CEO of the Massachusetts Health Quality Partners. And I want to welcome you all to this webinar to share our progress to date on the co-design work that we've been doing together to improve how we assess pain and better calibrate pain assessment with opioid prescribing. In the many conversations I've had with all kinds of people about this project, I've not met a single person who's not been excited by this work, and we really appreciate your interest. So thank you for joining today. We have on this call members of MHQP's Board of Physician Council, our Health Plan Council, our Consumer Council, and staff, as well as colleagues who've helped us in this work in our research phase and as participants in our workshop. So we welcome you. We're excited to share our findings with you and look forward to your questions and comments. Before we move on, two things that are important. One is please mute your lines, and whatever you do, don't put us on hold, because that is sort of very distracting, and it's difficult to rectify. There is a chat box at the bottom of your screen, labeled chat, right?
Yes.
So if you have any questions, Just type in those questions, and we will be responding to questions during the Q&A at the end of the call. So, and at the end of this presentation, everybody will receive an email with a slide deck. So that will be made available to you. Just a quick about us. This project has been co-sponsored by MHQP. We are a broad-based regional health improvement collaborative with a 21-year history of bringing together stakeholders to improve care, to measure it, and to drive improvements in patient experience and patient engagement and healthcare quality. And we are very committed to a multi-stakeholder approach. MADPOW is a strategic design consultancy that we have teamed up with that works on human-centered design to come up with solutions that work for people and for business, and it's been a great partnership working together with them. Next slide, please. We also want to thank Cigna, who funded the first phase of this initiative, and we're very appreciative of that. Next slide. So welcome to those who are just joining. I want to introduce the team, and then I will hand this over to members of the team. So maybe, I don't know if you're unmuted, but if you can say hello, folks on the team, to get a voice recognition, that would be great. Amy Cueva is the founder and chief experience officer at MADPOW.
Hi, everyone.
This is Barbara Rafson. I don't believe we have Adam Connor, but Dan Coleman is on the phone.
Hi, everybody. Hello.
And Chris Toll.
Yep, hi.
Great. And the next slide, we've got other members of the team. We've got Adam Hero.
Very good. Hello, and good afternoon, everyone.
And other folks that have been part of the team are Karen Smith, Pam Ressler, and Michelle Davis. So we are here to tell you about the work that we've done, and our focus is on trying to come up, as I mentioned, as a better way to assess pain. When it comes to pain, patients, doctors, and patients have a hard time partnering with each other. It's really it's a difficult situation that we have a very it's a very emotional time. People are often feeling isolated and hurt dejected. The patients and clinicians are also have issues of not having the proper understanding of all the reasons for complex pain. And too often this leads to really dysfunctional conversations over prescribing of opioids. And we felt that we would take a deep dive and involve all stakeholders in better understanding how do you assess pain and what is going on during those conversations. So next slide. So our challenge is how might we improve conversations between clinicians and their patients suffering from serious pain to enhance the ways in which they assess and understand pain, and we are focused on the outpatient setting. So I'm going to hand this over to Amy, who will go over the next few slides.
Great. So in terms of our approach, we used a human-centered approach, which basically is the philosophy that if we design with people who are affected by these solutions or lack thereof, that we'll be more effective in serving them. So we really wanted to have a participatory design process where initially we did research with experts, stakeholders, families, clinicians to get their perspective and sort of form some hypotheses that we would then validate during a participatory design session where we would start to deepen our level of understanding in the space and start to explore potential solutions. The approach was also evidence-based, so we did comprehensive literature review to understand what successes have happened and what we could leverage potentially in our approach.
Do you want to go to the next slide? Amy, just call out next slide, all the speakers, and we'll change
okay.
The
order. Perfect. So, you know, as I mentioned, we did the literature review and expert interviews and stakeholder research. And then we had a really wonderful co-design workshop with patients, family members, experts, and clinicians. And it was great to get perspectives from all of those involved, an understanding of obstacles, pain points, challenges, and ideally, what would help improve the situation and start to discuss what angle could we take in improving things. And so at the end of all of that, we came up with some strategic findings, some recommendations of how we move forward. And if you go to the next slide, I'll explain the kind of phases of this project to you. So we've just wrapped up the phase one, phase of really diving into the problem space and starting to explore the solution space. We've come up with good concepts that we can move forward with. And in phase two, begin to prototype those solutions and test them and get feedback on them so that then in phase two and even moving into phase three, we can pilot it, start to build an evidence basis for the solution. Now, this project, you know, with MHQP and with the Center for Health Experience Design, our goal is to create things that the industry can use. And so share best practices, insights, guidelines, and ultimately our goal is to have a tool that's been through pilot and trial that has some evidence that, you know, then health systems can use and patients and clinicians alike can get value from. Yeah, so, I mean, it was just amazing all the people we were able to bring together. And Barbara, did you want to add something here?
No, I just, Dan was going to pick up.
Yeah, this is Dan. I'd be happy to. So just to run with where Amy left us, our research, as she pointed out, was both human-centered and immersive, and it was also evidence-based. So another way to say that is we had two very different kinds of research here. One was working with a more expert population. Ron Heifetz calls this something like folks who are on the balcony, who see the situation from a distance, who see many different interactions, see people acting in a number of different contexts, and the distance that they have from the situation gives them the power to kind of have a real strong point of view, that's more general. That was the expert population we talked to. Those were, for example, pain specialists, investors in this sector, who had that kind of really powerful, broad perspective. But we also spoke to a very different kind of person as part of the human-centered work of it, which was people we call stakeholders, who are down on the dance floor in the middle of these interactions, the people who are the patients, the people suffering from acute pain, from chronic pain, the PCPs responding to them, the nurses, the pharmacists, all the people who are down in the mix, who spend perhaps like their every day dealing directly with these kind of issues. And we did a series of very in-depth interviews with both these experts and also with these stakeholders to try and get a sense of not only what they think about what's going on in this interaction, but also what it feels like to be in the middle of it, what their realities are like, what's scary to them, what's exciting to them, what they're worried about, what they really care about, what makes things hard, what sometimes makes things easy. And so as we move through the research, as I give you a sense of it, I'll try not to read all the details of what we discovered, but rather just give you a little bit of a sense of what we learned from people, kind of about how things feel, give you a little bit of that kind of on-the-ground flavor of things. Could we turn to the next slide, please? So to start just with a quick overview, as we step back and looked over all the things we learned, we realized that there are at least three major dimensions to this problem. And those are down in the left column here. The first part of the problem is the simple physiology of it, that is how we're built. There's the fact that pain is fundamentally subjective. It happens inside us, it's invisible to others, and there's not yet any objective way of measuring someone else's pain. All we can get is their report of it. Pain is complex, and what we mean by that is, I'll give you a quote that we heard from someone we spoke to, just to give you a sense of what we really meant by it. We heard someone say, when a person comes to see his doctor after getting kicked out by his family, there's no way that a doctor alone can make that pain go away. When a person goes to a priest in confession and says, I hurt all over, and they also have metastatic cancer, there's no way that priest can solve that pain on his own. Pain, this guy said, isn't just one thing, and we've got to stop treating it like it is. That's the sense in which we mean that it's deeply complex. If I skip down to the next row here, you can see that another crucial factor that contributes to the problem of pain is the how we interact with each other, the roles we play in these different interactions. So one very strong role is just the ways in which doctors feel that they are expected to just fix it, and that many patients treat them as though they are the expert. And both sides kind of expect that that's the role they're supposed to play. One doctor we spoke to said that he said, I'm a diagnostic machine. My job is to figure things out. And if you put me in a situation where it's not so clear, where things get really vague, I get really uncomfortable, and I'm much less sure of what I'm supposed to do. Another very important way to see the problem that pain presents to us is to think about it on a systemic level, the last row there. And those are really just the larger context within which these interactions operate. And you can see these are just a few of what we saw, some of the most important aspects of this. There's limited access to multimodal care, to biopsychosocial care. The healthcare system and its players are in many ways adapted to provide acute care, and not so good perhaps at chronic kinds of conditions. And that reimbursement policies, for example, similarly support kind of quick procedures, but not so much extended consultation. If we could go to the next slide, please. So what we have here, So we have, what we have here is a whole lot of information, which I'll leave for you guys to read in detail afterwards. Let me just quickly describe the way we've organized it here. The left column, the key unmet needs, are in some sense the rawest data we received. These are very close to this, the specific things we heard people say, things that we heard a number of people say. These are patterns that we heard over and over again, concerns, needs that came up through the many people we spoke to. The middle column was our attempt to identify. So if the left column is these are the things that people need and want, the middle column is the things existing in the world that get in the way, the barriers to their satisfaction. And then the right column is the things people do in response. They have these needs, the world gets in the way, and they respond. Sometimes they come up with great solutions that are very adaptive, and quite often they come up with pretty terrible solutions, which get them and other people in all sorts of trouble and don't help the situation any. So we both have adaptive and maladaptive behaviors. So that's just the overall layout of the way we've kind of analyzed the data we found. I'll just give a little bit of color to a few of these items here to give you a sense of what we heard from people on the ground. Some of the strongest things, if you look in that left column that we heard, is an enormous feeling among the people suffering from pain that they really wanted to be listened to, and that often they weren't, that they wanted to get care that's right for them in particular, because they really have been understood as an individual. They often felt on the flip side that they were just kind of getting a one-size-fits-all generic kind of approach. Or sometimes they felt like someone really wasn't trying hard to diagnose the root cause of their pain. No matter how, we had someone say something like, I was pointing directly to where it hurt, and my physician seemed to be ignoring what I was saying to him. It is very interesting that these kinds of needs that we saw with acute patients suffering from acute pain became exaggerated in significant ways when we talked with people who are suffering from chronic pain in ways that I think were suggestive, so that what starts to happen with people who enter into chronic pain is that it's not just that they're not being listened to or not being taken seriously in their experience, but they start to feel like they're treated almost like a criminal at times. And quite often, almost across the board, we heard people say they had this feeling that they were crazy, that they were being treated as though they were crazy. That is, there was something going on inside them that was incredibly true to them, but nobody in the outside world could see it. And they felt like an enormous part of their struggle and tension was simply trying to make people believe that what they knew to be true, what they knew to be going on inside them, was really true and was really happening. So from the patients with acute pain, that was a crucial part of what we heard. There was similarly a real fear, especially nowadays with all the media attention to these concerns, a real concern about getting addicted, about getting hooked. And also, I just wanted to call out one last point here. Help me feel sure this won't last forever. One of the things that we saw that was very promising, I guess you'd say, is how on the negative side, people were walked into this really intense pain. They encountered this really intense pain and didn't know where it was leading or what might happen next. And they were part of their terror, part of their suffering came from their vast uncertainty. They had no idea what was happening. And we found that when in interactions where healthcare providers were able simply to do things that allowed the patients to frame their pain, to understand what might be coming, to give them a way to think about it. For example, it was enormously beneficial to them. So, for example, we talked to one surgeon who talked about how he tells his patients, the pain will be incredibly intense, but it's a 36-hour storm of pain, and then it'll be better. And we found that was that simple framing, that sense of the limit of the pain, was enormously powerful. We saw similarly that people, that when doctors were able to help patients think of their pain, their chronic pain as a disease, like diabetes, that it pretty much changed the way that doctors and patients would relate to each other, and that it started to set up a kind of partnership, which responded to the enormous problem that Barbara spoke to at the beginning, which was the lack of trust, the way in which these interactions between people suffering from pain and healthcare providers responding to them, for all sorts of reasons, get into a very untrusting relationship. If we move to the next slide, you can see that much of what we heard from doctors was this fear that they're, I guess you could say, fear that they're getting scammed. They were so concerned that the person in front of them might be lying to them, might be deceiving them, might be asking for drugs in order to divert them. And they were very worried, both in terms of how if the person from was not intentionally looking to divert, they were also concerned that the person might be one of those people who was just disposed to addiction. And they were very afraid because they had no way of telling whether this person in front of them actually was. And so they were they recognized they'd taken an oath to do no harm and feared that they might do someone terrible harm. And they were also afraid that if they were to take the wrong kind of actions with someone and prescribe in the wrong kind of way, they might even lose their license. So both the kind of these different kinds of fear were operating here. It was also very interesting to see simply what it felt like for doctors to work with patients in pain, especially patients with chronic pain. And we had one doctor say something like, my work with pain patients is the most miserable part of my week. And just to recognize how much stress, how much strain that these patients could put on doctors. And we wanted to, we also saw as we talked to doctors, if you look in the middle column here, these barriers to satisfaction, one of the things we discovered is just how hard it is, we talk about in the middle column here, it's difficult to admit error or course correct. One of the things we saw was how hard it is for physicians trained and expected to be experts to acknowledge that a course of treatment they may have started isn't working anymore. And simply to change course can be an enormous problem, and an enormous obstacle to actually doing what you discover might be a better thing, or trying an experiment that might be better than what you've been doing in the past, having to admit that the treatment you've done so far is not working. And similarly, we've seen just the human interaction, the difficulty of confronting patients. That often what happened was doctors would be working with their patients, and they wouldn't know who among their patients was likely to get addicted, and they felt very uncomfortable having a hard conversation with patients when they felt that they were. That they were treating, that it was very difficult for them to treat potential patients in front of them as potential addicts, and that was a very difficult kind of conversation to have. And on the flip side, we saw that some doctors had set up protocols where it wasn't up to them, it wasn't on them to have that hard conversation in the moment. It was rather like a standard conversation that was had with patients as a matter of course. And so just to suggest both the difficulties of these situations, of these interactions, but also the opportunities we saw for often very small-scale solutions that could really change things around. Can we go to the next slide, please? And as Amy described earlier, one of the most exciting parts of the project was to shift from these this kind of expert research and then this immersive research to getting down into the middle of the problem with all the stakeholders we talked about. So we spent a full day workshop at MedPAL's office in Boston with about 30 stakeholders drawn from all these different groups we've talked about. And we started out by kind of expanding on what we had learned from them, a session where we listened to all, to the different stories in the room. And then we shifted into a wild afternoon session where we tried to articulate the, as precisely as we could, the problems that we were facing, the challenges before us, and started solving them together. And that's how we spent the day. And that, that took us to a very different place than we had been before. I'll hand off to our next speaker on the next slide.
Great. Thanks so much, Dan. So as this is Adam from MedPAL. As part of this initiative, you know, Dan covered off on a lot of the key issues that came up, particularly in the interactions with the primary care providers. So what we did is created a series of illustrated journeys to really kind of create a narrative around the different issues that patients, providers, payers, and support networks are facing, and put that into a sharper relief. And you know, create a story that was easier to wrap people's heads around. The journeys that we have in the presentation today are summarized versions. We do have more detailed pages for each one. But for purposes of today, I'll quickly step through some of the key pain points, so to speak, that each of these journeys highlight. So if we can go to the next slide. One of the obvious key interactions is when the patient is meeting with a primary care provider, and Dan really touched on a lot of this in the material that he just covered. But as you can see in the text on this page, there's a real struggle that patients have in terms of proving that the pain that they have is real, and you know, feeling like the doctor really understands where they're coming from. And in the course of the different discussions that we had, we really saw that the source of frustration really seems to come from a sense of uncertainty on both sides of the equation. For the patient, as I mentioned, they may feel like the doctor isn't really listening to their particular situation. And then from the provider perspective, they may feel like they might not have a complete understanding of pain in order to really prescribe the treatment that's most appropriate, and they may just default to things that they have seen work in the past, even though it may not be specific to what that particular patient is going through. We also heard that patients feel like there's got to be some sort of specific diagnostic that will just tell the doctor, this is what I'm going through and this is how you need to treat it. And in fact, many of those existing tests that the doctors may use may come back negative, and that can lead the patient to feel like nobody understands them and just emphasizes that sense of hopelessness that they may have. And then for those patients who may already have an opioid prescription, and Dan touched on this a bit, some providers may not can't help but wonder if the patients might be asking for a specific drug because of a habit that they fear may be already in place, and they don't want to feed into that, not only in terms of the patient's health, but also what that might mean for their record on their own. And then if they want to try and shift the course of treatment, there are concerns there in terms of, you know, the patient getting upset of moving away from what they know has worked in the past and, you know, having a fear of making that shift. If we move on to the next slide, the next journey that we talked about was the patient meeting with the nurse. And we heard many of the similar issues in terms of that patient and provider interaction. With the interactions with nurses, but because of in some cases there's an increased amount of dialogue that happens between patient and nurses, the dynamic here is a bit different. So in some cases the nurse may feel that the doctor isn't hearing the same depth of information that maybe they're hearing, and they may struggle with how to communicate that to the doctor. In other instances, the nurses may feel like the patients aren't necessarily respecting their authority and their position as compared to the doctor, and that might lead the patients to being dismissive or lashing out at the nurses, and maybe, you know, creating a bit of an unsafe working environment for the nurse there. On the flip side, from the patient standpoint, they may actually end up, you know, feeling like they can have more of a connection and reveal more information to the nurse than they may to the doctor. And there may be some behaviors that the nurse hears about that they feel there might be something suspicious going on, and how do they communicate that back to the doctor? And then lastly, one of the unique circumstances we heard here was for patients who maybe may have had mental health issues in the past, they might feel hesitant to share those details because they may fear that disclosing that information might compromise the treatment options that are put in front of them. So again, a difficulty in sharing information really leads to that growing divide. If we move on to the next slide. Another key player here is the pharmacist. And, you know, so obviously the providers and the nurses are at the forefront of the treatment, but pharmacists play a very key role here. And really, they have the opportunity to potentially play an even greater role, but the nature of that retail environment that they're in really kind of creates a barrier to empower the pharmacist in many respects. Adding to that, in some cases, when the patient's going in to pick up their prescription, very often, you know, there may be a sense of shame or embarrassment associated with that, and so they see that medication pickup as a necessary evil. They don't want to have a conversation. They just want to pick up that medication and get out of there as quickly as they can. If the patient is willing to talk again, the environment of the pharmacy does not necessarily lend itself to that. And, you know, any discussion that the pharmacist may want to have may be difficult knowing that there might be a line forming behind who they're talking with, and that lack of privacy can create a real challenge there. And then there's also the point where the pharmacist has to make sure that the prescription is legitimate. There are checks that they need to do, and that's is right at odds with the patient's potential desire to just be able to get that medication and go. And so when the doctor goes and has to check on that, or sorry, the pharmacist has to go and check on that, they may feel like, oh, they're under suspicion and create that sense of mistrust. Moving on to the next slide. Another key player here is the payer, the insurance companies. And those interactions with payers often can feature antagonism from the patient who might see the insurer as a roadblock to getting that necessary treatment. But our discussions with payers have really highlighted that there are insights that the insurers feel like they may have into treatment and the patient journey and kind of that central role that the payer plays as a connector between the patient and the provider, that they may be able to provide a greater amount of insight than they have been up to this point. As I sort of alluded to already, much of the frustration may come from denied coverage and patients feeling like the one treatment that they feel they know has worked in the past, a particular medication, maybe not being covered. So they get frustrated by that, feel like they're not being heard. For the payer, they may send a communication to a patient who is currently on an opioid, even if it is covered, and that may actually, any receipt from the patient of some sort of communication about that, they might feel like their privacy is being intruded on or that there might be a disruption in their coverage, and that might cause the patient to shy away from wanting to engage in that communication with the insurer. From the payer standpoint, they, as I referenced, they have access to a lot of research that helps inform their coverage policies, but being able to communicate the nuance of that to patients can feel impractical, if not impossible, very difficult to be able to share that information. The system's not really set up well that way. And then payers also have access to a lot of data on treatments that may not actually be ideal for patients. And being able to leverage that information that they see in determining which of the providers in their network are providing informed quality care would be a great proactive step to trying to improve the paths of treatment that that providers are following. The last narrative that we have, if we can move on to the next slide, is really the support network, friends and family, and the patient's interactions with those. We know that patients really need to lean on friends and family for support, but these people are really in a position to really be as informed as they could be to provide the support when it's needed most. So we heard often that there are stories of a spouse or a friend not being able to relate to what the patient is going to, which can deepen that sense of isolation. In some cases, patients may feel like they're under a pallor of suspicion because they've asked for prescriptions so often, and they may even ask a friend or a family member to be the one to go in complaining of the pain so that they can get the prescription through them. The changes that patients who are suffering from chronic pain have to make in their lives obviously has an effect on the whole family, and that can change the whole family dynamic and reducing the amount of things that people can do and that can make that patient kind of feel like a failure or inadequate as part of that. And then the struggle is also on the friends and family in terms of, you know, if they're constantly exposed to this, they can get frustrated with that, where pain has really become a focus of their lives. So just that's a quick run through of the different kind of unique inflection points on each of these journeys. There's even more to each one of these. But as we move forward with the presentation today and we start talking about, so where do we go from here, you'll see where we're proposing starts to address some of these areas of lack of communication and mistrust.
Thanks, Adam. Next slide. So you can imagine the challenge of coming up with findings given all this incredibly rich information. And this is Barbara Raffson speaking again. One of the things that we found is it was really like peeling an onion and coming up with layers and layers of, and it just felt like layers of dysfunction, honestly, that that the tools that we are currently using to assess pain and the way we communicate with patients about managing pain in this country is very dysfunctional, it's full of flaws, and it's leading to all kinds of unnecessary suffering. And so for what we were trying to do is say, okay, what are the key areas or findings so that we can think about what we should be doing about them? So here's five key findings that we came up with. And I think that this approach is quite different than the normal approach in healthcare to, you know, coming up with solutions. For one thing, you've just heard, you know, for the last 40 minutes about how deep a dive we took trying to first understand the literature, but then talking to everybody about what it means to them, what it feels like, what's going on in some of these interactions. And one of the things that comes to the top is that pain is not well understood, and that leads to fear and uncertainty on all sides. And that, you know, there's a certain amount of, we just don't know that much about pain and its pathology and etiology and, sort of how it works and how it differs across people. And it's, you know, because it is so subjective and it depends on what's going on in a person's life. So there's just layers upon layers of uncertainty. And we just don't, you know, we haven't addressed that. We've also the second finding is that there can be a lack of trust between patients, providers, and payers, which contributes to suffering, which we've talked a fair amount about, this lack of trust. There's many barriers to successful pain assessment conversation, including, you know, a dearth of training and tools. I mean, we had docs saying that, you know, this is what I feel like I have to work with. And it was very limited, and it was not getting the results that they wanted, yet they kept doing it again and again, which, you know, as we all know, is sort of the definition of insanity to do the same thing over and over and expect different results. So there was, you know, a lot of frustration, lack of tools, and lack of time. I mean, one of the issues that came up again and again is that in order to have true communication, you need to establish relationships, and that takes time. And in the whirlwind of our daily sort of medical practice, there's not time built in to establish these relationships so that you could really understand what's going on. And that's driven largely by the fourth area, policy and payment issues create barriers to appropriate treatment. There's, you know, the timing that I mentioned, but as Adam mentioned, as we better understood what's going on with health plans and coverage of different approaches and treatments, the world that we live in terms of everything being evidence-based and how evidence is measured, it felt like, wait a minute, maybe it's worth taking a step back. So, for example, all the evidence-based research is done on does it relieve pain and function. And one of the things that came across really strongly is that resilience, the patient's resilience, is really key to them doing better. And so we don't measure what approaches do to increase resilience. I mean, it's just not, that's not the scale that we use. So it's just a lot of opportunity to think about, you know, our policy and payment approaches, plus the policies that have come down across the board around reducing opioid prescribing, sort of just, you know, say, okay, limit X number of pills. And that, you know, what that means, and other prescribers sort of being discouraged from prescribing opioids, means it's harder for those actually who do need opioids to find someone where they can go and they can find someone who will prescribe them for them. And then finally, in setting mutual goals and encouraging empowerment and hope and agency for patients is very often a crucial missing approach in care delivery. It's something that, you know, it doesn't happen. And one of the things that we, and during the workshop, one of the physicians said that we have a lot to learn from Edward Trudeau about the care of people with tuberculosis. Here was a disease that we didn't know how to cure, but we took care of people. What we tried to do was to cure sometimes, to relieve often, and to comfort always. And when you, if you sort of exchange patients with pain as opposed to people with patients with tuberculosis and thought, okay, that's the approach then, it's very different than the approach now. So I am going to, as I said, we have details behind each of these key findings, but we'll flip through those and move to the next, because we want to have some opportunity for you to tell you what we're proposing for phase two and then get your feedback. So Amy, do you want to take it from here?
Yes. So through this webinar, you have the opportunity to learn what we learned throughout the entire phase one, and we want to share with you where we intend to go from here. And, you know, our intention is to continue the conversation with you. We are looking for sponsors for phase two and three, and we're also looking for collaborators for phase two and three. So if you go to the next slide, I'll kind of explain what we have planned for coming up. So through phase one, we identified some potential approaches, and there's certainly opportunity to explore each of these discreetly and independently as a solution, but there's also potential to see some overlap between these things and sort of look at the ecosystem and potentially blend some solutions. But where we're looking at focusing is in phase two to actually create prototypes of some tools. So that would be something that, you know, if it was a print piece you could hold in your hand, or if it was a digital thing you could, you know, click through and see the screens, or if it was a discussion guide you'd be able to like use it and test it. So we want to create the tools and we want to have them be tested from a usefulness and usability perspective. Part of innovation process is let's get feedback early and often instead of spending a ton of time and money not knowing if it's going to work and then put it into trial or pilot. Let's get some early feedback, refine, pivot if we need to, et cetera. So that's going to be the goal of phase two. And in phase two, we'll either look at improving provider assessment skills, creating a playbook for patients that will help them navigate the whole process, prepare for visits, ask the right questions, and understand various options. And then look at how do we increase the evidence, distribution of evidence, and effective ways to treat pain. So something that definitely came through with providers is, you know, evidence resonates. And so we can provide guidance around what works and provide the evidence basis to them, that will be great. And again, that can overlap with solution one, improving provider assessment skills. You know, evidence can be a key component of that. And it could also overlap with item two, you know, even presenting evidence-based information to patients as well. So if you go to the next slide. So first, we are going to create the tools, like I said, and these could be patient and physician-facing training modules, forms, discussion guides, and, you know, the tools could involve education for, you know, many of the behaviors seen, the social neuroscience. It could help establish context for patients who are reporting pain and the impact to their lives. Also, could induce a sense of kind of partnership throughout the pain journey, and so not just be one single interaction, but kind of help create an ongoing relationship and partnership. Expectation setting, you know, a lot of fear around, okay, how long is this going to last? How bad is it going to be? If we can help set expectations, that's going to be helpful. If we can expose different treatment options with risks and benefits, that will be good. And then education for family members and for patients on how to spot addiction and overdose and what to do. So the creation of these tools will be exploring these different areas, and that's in terms of content, and it's also in terms of how could we effectively support conversation, support research, support follow-up, and that type of thing. And then if you go to the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit about what would come after the tool creation. Then we would build these things out and test them. And the kind of testing, it isn't a pilot test, and we're not going to be getting a huge amount of evidence through these tests. It's going to be a limited audience, just to get, like I said, that early feedback where we can refine the tool and create an estimate for what it's going to take to fully deploy this tool set and put it into trial and pilot, where we can actually start understanding if it's working, how it's working, so that then many more organizations can get use out of it. We are looking for a sponsor for phase two and for phase three, and collaborators for both. Ideally, we would have a health system or two to partner with for feedback, and we absolutely need a health system involvement for phase three, where we would pilot the solution.
Thank you, Amy. So now we have time for your questions and comments. There's two different ways. You can either go to at the bottom of the screen, if you hover your arrow under participants and then click on that, you get to a screen that shows who's on, and then you can raise your hand to ask a question, or you can type in a question into the chat box. Okay, Michelle?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just want to say to you, Barbara, Amy, Dan, and Adam, that I think this work is amazing. And it's just such common sense, but sometimes it takes this level of investigation and thinking and conversations to get there. So congratulations to the whole team for uncovering on a very deep level these issues that need to be addressed if we're going to overall address the issue. And I guess the one comment I had around assessment tools is around physician communication. I was very much struck by the comment that one of you made that physicians don't know how to have these conversations, and then so they sort of pass them off to someone else or don't have the conversations. It reminds me of end-of-life care, and the fact that that was also an uncomfortable conversation, and how often, well, I know over at Children's, in any case, that the simulation unit was kind of used, set up to actually practice these conversations. And so one of the things I was thinking about is whether you were thinking about giving physicians an opportunity to practice having these conversations, because I think that's one of the only ways you can incorporate that into their behaviors, is to give them an opportunity to practice and learn in a safe environment. So just curious what you thought about that idea and whether that's a consideration you have.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. I'll start out by answering that was one of the things that came out loud and clear, that clinicians, just as patients are all very different, clinicians are all very different. And even if they had the same toolbox, their comfort with using the tools in the toolbox varied. And so people need practice for sure. That is, and these are hard conversations. And I think, from a trust standpoint, there are so many barriers to trust because, you know, patients come in and they've been dismissed so many, you know, many times in some cases, and they feel like they're entirely on their own and nobody's there with them. And clinicians are feeling like, you know, I don't have the tools. And then there's this whole issue of, you know, opioid shopping, that once you've been burned, you know, you're burned. And so you there's some suspicion. And so there's so many natural things feeding into, you know, a really difficult conversation that, you know, all of absolutely you need practice in those scenarios. I mean, it's not as though, oh, okay, I can just say this. It's there's a lot of very difficult things going on. So I think practice for sure makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you and great
thank
idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dan. That's a great question, Michelle. I'd add on to what to the question you're asking and Barbara's response to it, that on the one hand, these are very subtle, rich, complicated kinds of conversations to have, and consequently, they take a whole lot of practice, and that's definitely true. And there are all sorts of great approaches that are out there. We heard a lot of people talk about the power of motivational interviewing, for example. One of the things that's also very interesting is how there are also some kind of low-hanging fruit out there, in the sense of while it's certainly true that in order to have a really great conversation with someone, it takes a lot of practice and it's really hard, there are some very simple things that we heard doctors saying and that we heard patients responding to, which don't require a whole lot of training or even a whole lot of practice, and which you could actually pretty easily imagine kind of communicating, showing doctors a really quick little video that could give them a sense of these quick little conversations that would start to frame their relationship with patients much more powerfully. And that doctors who might not be the best communicators in the world or might not be so experienced in having these complex, you know, challenging conversations could actually say, you know, these kind of simple phrases, this kind of give a standard sort of line, and it starts to set things off on a very different kind of footing than they might otherwise go. So there are also some surprisingly simple tools that we could provide that could also make a big difference. So that's really hopeful.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
Other questions? Comments? I'm really curious from some of those who participated both in the research and or the workshop itself, like, did we lose anything or did anything surprise you with our summary of the process and the findings or anything to add?
Hi, everyone. Excuse me. This is Bryn Cole. I am an innovation specialist with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I actually teach human-centered design training to staff here and throughout our region. And I participated as a patient because I had broken my ankle last spring. And I just wanted to say from both a personal and a professional level, it was so fulfilling to participate in this program and really see what, you know, the experience on the other end. You know, we talk to our patients a lot about problems that that we're experiencing as well. So it was just really enlightening to be on the other end of human-centered design inquiry and then to see this report out and just really, you know, see some frustrations that I had expressed along with the nuance from both providers and other patients was really cool. And I think you have all done an excellent job with this.
Thanks, Bryn. Thanks for participating, too. I hope your ankle's better.
Yeah, we're getting there. Thanks.
Cindy? Oh, great. Cindy?
Yeah, hi. I think you did a great job capturing a lot of what goes on in pain. And I would just add to that for you to take a look at some of the tools that doctors use, like opioid contracts and urine analysis, and how those are, I think, contributing to lack of trust and patients feeling like they came in talking about pain. They had nothing to do with opioids, and yet here they are being, you know, given contracts and told this is how they're going to have to work with them. And some of those are very off-putting if not really presented right, and can really, you know, detract from the ability to build trust. So I would look at, you know, kind of the tools that are used in practices and how to change those.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. I think this whole process really opened our eyes to say, you know, well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, for one thing, and that, but you can do so much damage unintentionally if you don't, you know, sort of understand the you know, the full impact of what you're doing.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. Might have time for one more comment or question. Okay. Well, I thank you all for joining us. As we said, we will be providing the slide deck, and as Adam said, we literally have 70 slides of this. They're very big, so it goes into a great amount of detail, but we will share the presentation that that we shared, and we'd love to hear from you once you've had a time to look at it even more. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear from you. And as Amy said, we are looking for organizations who might be interested in working with us further, and also potential funders for the next phases of this work, which feels incredibly important. So thank you all for joining us and for your interest, and we hope to stay in touch.